Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. This week, musicians and songwriters draw AI red lines. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we're going to take a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. A week when London's Brixton Academy began preparing to reopen after Lambeth Council's licensing subcommittee ruled late on the previous Friday that Academy Music Group can reopen the venue, but only once 77 conditions are met to ensure the safety of concertgoers and employees after last year's fatal crowd crush.
Yes, we spoke about this story a few times on Setlist earlier this year. The Brixton Academy in London has been closed ever since last December when that crowd crush incident occurred. And then earlier this month, there was a full two-day hearing by Lambeth Council's licensing subcommittee. At that hearing, the London's Metropolitan Police restated their position that while they did not want to see the Brixton Academy close as a venue, they were not happy with the current operators of the venue, Live Nation's Academy Music Group, having the license. They felt that the license should be revoked. However, at the same session, legal representatives for AMG presented a plan, quite an extensive plan that they have put forward with changes they're going to make to the way the venue is run. And a representative actually for the officials at Lambeth Council said that that was a rigorous, comprehensive plan. They were happy with the plan. And the committee that ultimately makes the decision said, yes, we are happy for the venue to reopen. But as you say, with 77 conditions, so a lot of that was what AMG had already proposed. But I think there were some other things added during the licensing hearing itself. But it should mean that the Brixton Academy is reopening at some point in the next few months once all those changes are in place. So yeah, that's a development that has occurred since the last time we had a set list, or certainly since the last time we talked about this story on set list. I'm traveling at the moment, so I'm finding it a bit confusing to remember what happened when, and maybe I should just mention that because I'm in another hotel room, a different hotel room to when we recorded set list last week. Not so hot and sticky like it was last week when I was in Croatia, although I am in Hamburg for the Reeper Barn Festival, and I'm in a hotel room overlooking one end of the Reeper Barn. So if there's any sounds coming in from outside, you'll know why. I'll just sort of get it. There may be an echo. There may be who knows what happening on the Reeper Barn that we can hear in the background on this podcast. But forgive that, because hopefully I've got some interesting stuff to say, so it doesn't matter what the audio is like.
Interesting stuff. And, well, that's a bold commitment there. We're going to put you to the test. Let's see what interesting stuff you have to say about what we're here, actually here, to discuss this week. Because later on, we'll be discussing the RIAA's latest stats on US recorded music retail revenues. But first, organisations representing UK music makers last week called for consent, respect and remuneration to be central to the development of music AI platforms and tools, calling on technology companies and the music industry at large to meet five fundamental objectives. Those five objectives were published by the Council of Music Makers, which brings together the Ivors Academy, the Featured Artists Coalition, the Musicians Union, the Music Producers Guild, and the Music Managers Forum. They were formally unveiled at a Global Creators Summit staged by the Ivors Academy in London last week, where AI was the focus. And the Council of Music Makers organisations said in a statement, "We all recognise that AI presents opportunities for the music business. However, the rights of music makers, including artists, musicians, songwriters, and studio producers, must be respected by technology companies and rights holders as music AI models are trained and new AI-powered products and services are developed. That begins with AI companies respecting copyright and lawmakers ensuring that no new copyright exceptions are introduced to reduce those obligations," they go on. But in addition to these basic requirements, there are five further fundamentals that must be met.
That is indeed what they said. What are those five further fundamentals? Well, we're not going to tell you right away. I'm going to give you a little bit of background, and then I'm pretty sure Andy Malt will read them out for you because he's that kind of guy. But as
read
you know,
I've memorized them.
Maybe you could wrap them. You're going to wrap them? That would be good.
No, not happening.
Maybe we could, get one of those AIs that create speech to just turn them into a very eloquent, professional-sounding voice. Not that I'm suggesting that your voice is neither eloquent nor professional-sounding anyway.
Yeah, how do you know I've not done this via AI? I think that's how you know. Say your bit.
I'll say my bit, but I'm glad our listeners now know that this is human beings speaking, because while generative AI is not yet perfect, it wouldn't fuck up in the way that Andy Bolt just did. So we did that just to prove this is genuine. The point is, bit of background, as we all know, music making AI has been a big talking point in the industry for many months now. We've talked about it before on Setlist, and indeed the consultancy side and the training side of CMU, we've been doing lots of work in this space. We mentioned the MMF, Music Manager's Interim Guide to AI, on last week's Setlist, I think. We've also been doing reports and training on AI for the BPI and for Impala, and indeed some consulting for the Council of Music Makers. So the consulting side of CMU is very much in the middle of all of this. Although, because we work for everybody, I think we do know everybody's viewpoints and everybody's opinions. So let's see if we can have some balance in our discussion of this big story. As you know, because we've talked about it before on Setlist, and you read all the articles that we publish in the CMU Daily, and we've said this many times, when it comes to music making AI, there is one thing that unites the entire music industry, whether we're talking about artists, songwriters, musicians, producers, labels, publishers, distributors, collecting societies. In the main, I mean, obviously, there's always a few mavericks in the music community who may disagree with this, but in the main, the music industry is aligned with the position that any technology company that trains a music-making generative AI model by using existing music must get permission from whoever owns the copyright in that music before they do it. So basically negotiate a licensing deal with whichever labels, distributors, publishers, collecting societies control those rights. As I'm pretty sure we've also mentioned on Setlist before, while the music industry is very much aligned on that point, not all tech companies agree. And indeed, last week, as the Council of Music Makers were putting out these five fundamentals, Meta, the company which runs Facebook and Instagram, among other things, of course, filed a response to a lawsuit in the US that has been filed against it and its text-based generative AI model. This is a lawsuit that's been filed by some writers and authors, including the comedian Sarah Silverman, where they are basically accusing Meta of copyright infringement for training their text-based generative AI model on a whole load of journalism and literature and existing writing without getting permission from the copyright owners in all of that written material. They've also sued OpenAI and ChatGPT on this. And in its response to that lawsuit in the US courts last week, Meta basically said, our training of our generative AI models is fair use, which is to say, under American copyright law, as far as they are concerned, that tricky concept of fair use applies when tech companies take copyright-protected works and use them to train generative AI models, which basically means they are saying, we don't need a license. We don't need permission to get this. So both Meta and actually a couple of weeks ago, OpenAI, have both floated the fair use defense in not music cases, because these are both cases being pursued by writers and authors, but nevertheless, those cases are testing a very important precedent of super relevance for the entire music industry, which is, under American copyright law, can the principle of fair use mean that in at least some circumstances, an AI company can use copyright-protected work without getting a license? The music industry, the entire music industry, hopes that the answer to that question is fair use does not apply. You need a license. So on that point, the entire music industry is pretty much aligned. However, and this brings us back to the CMM five fundamentals that were published last week, there is also a debate within the music industry over whether or not specific artists and songwriters and musicians must also provide their consent before any music that they have written or performed on is used to train an AI model. Because remember, it's quite common in the music industry for music makers to not actually own the copyright in the music that they have written or recorded or performed on. Sometimes, not always, and obviously it's more common now than it was in the past for artists and songwriters to retain ownership of their rights, but it's still pretty common for labels to control the recording rights and publishers and collecting societies to control the song rights, the publishing rights. So, question within the music community is, yes, we all agree that the copyright owner has to give permission for music to be used for the training of an AI, but what about the artists, the songwriters, the musicians? Is their consent required too? And the key point is, although the Council of Music Makers were agreeing with the rest of the music industry that the technology companies need to get consent before they use music, the key thing the CMM was saying was artist and songwriter consent is required as well, which would mean that a label and a publisher couldn't simply offer a license to a tech company for the songs or recordings where they control the copyright without first going to artists and songwriters and getting their approval.
Now, some music companies have made assurances that artists and songwriters will have control over whether or not their music is used by AI companies, or at least they've implied it. But in many cases, it remains unclear how music companies intend to manage the licensing of AI platforms. Many labels point out that although AI technologies are evolving fast, it's still early days, and it's not yet clear where the commercial opportunities really lie in AI. And while that's true, it's likely that the CMM organisations would argue that that doesn't stop music companies from making commitments regarding music maker consent.
Yes, and in some ways, what the CMM are currently saying in relation to music and AI can be connected to the ongoing conversation around the economics of streaming, which obviously we've talked about a huge amount on Setlist, because obviously with the whole conversation around how the streaming business model works that has been ongoing for a few years now, in some ways at the heart of the whole economics of streaming conversation from the perspective of artists and songwriters and their managers is this idea that in the late 2000s, when streaming first came along, the record companies, the music publishers, and in some cases the collecting societies developed a business model with Spotify and Deezer and subsequently Apple and Amazon, etc. And whether or not that's a good business model or a bad business model or whatever, there wasn't much consultation with or communication to the artists, the writers, and the managers. So for many years, how streaming worked was shrouded in secrecy, hence why the MMF worked with us here at CMU to do the Dissecting Digital Dollar reports and book. And even today, even though in the main, certainly managers and the more savvy artists and writers have a basic understanding of how streaming works, there's still lots of intricacies about the business model that the music maker community are not aware of. There's information lacking. And I guess there's a fear in the music maker community that something similar could happen in the AI space. Yes, the music makers are aligned with the labels and publishers in terms of the obligations of the technology companies, but maybe before these licensing deals are developed and negotiated and signed, there could be a conversation within the music community about what rights artists and songwriters have, how those rights will be managed and respected, and how any money down the line might be shared. This brings us, as promised, to what these five AI fundamentals are. And now I hand you back to the definitely not a robot, Andy Malt, to read them each in turn.
Thank you, Chris. Yes, here they are, the five fundamentals of AI from the Council of Music Makers. Number one, where licensing deals are negotiated in respect of AI technologies, the explicit consent of individual music makers must be secured before music is used to train AI models. Such consent cannot be inferred by rights holders or technology companies. Two, the publicity, personality, and personal data rights of music makers must be respected. These rights belong to individual music makers and cannot be exploited by AI companies or rights holders without explicit consent. The UK government should clarify and strengthen these rights and collaborate internationally to promote a robust global rights regime.
And without wanting to interrupt your lovely flow on these five fundamentals, just to quickly observe a bit more background information, that this idea of publicity rights or the right to publicity doesn't actually exist in UK law, but it does in some other countries, including some states in the US. And this is particularly relevant where generative AI is creating music in the style of specific artists, like the fake Drake tracks that we've talked a lot about this year. And where an artist's voice or style is being used or replicated, I guess, by a generative AI, there may well be copyright reasons why the company behind that technology needs to come to the music industry and negotiate some deals. But there is also an argument that even if an AI company negotiated a deal with a record label and a music publisher, and on the copyright side was covered and licensed in order to create a new Drake song or a new Taylor Swift song or a new Harry Styles song or whatever it is, arguably the artist's publicity rights, personality rights, image rights, different terminologies used around the world, would also be exploited in that scenario. So a separate deal would need to be done with the artist or the representatives in order to do that. So I guess this is the Council of Music Makers sort of really stressing this is not just about copyright, it's about these other rights as well, which may not formally exist in the UK yet, but they should do, and they do exist elsewhere in the world, and the industry needs to be aware of those rights and respecting those rights whenever they're doing deals with AI companies. And now I will stop interrupting your flow.
Thanks. Number three, where permission is granted, music makers must share fairly in the financial rewards of music AI, including from music generated by AI models trained on their work. Number four, as AI companies and rights holders develop licensing models, they must proactively consult music makers and reach agreement on how each stakeholder will share in the revenue from AI products and services. And finally, number five, AI-generated works must be clearly labelled as such, and AI companies must be fully transparent about the music that has been used to train their models, keeping and making available complete records of datasets. Rights holders must be transparent about all licensing deals that have been negotiated with AI companies and what works those deals include.
So those are the five AI fundamentals as published last week by the Council of Music Makers. If you'd rather read them than have Andy Malt read them to you, I'm sure Andy will put a link in the show notes because it's the kind of thing that he, or indeed the robot that's replaced Andy, would do. Finally, in talking about this, the boss of the BPI, the record label trade group, Joe Twist, issued a statement in response to the five fundamentals, because I guess, as we've said a few times, with the demands that the music makers were making, some of them were very much aimed at the AI companies, the technology companies, and they're pretty much the same demands that labels and publishers are making. But some of them were also demands of the artists and songwriters, business partners within the music industry, labels and publishers, hence why the BPI, as the UK trade body, for the record industry, for the record labels, issued a statement. And in that statement, Joe Twist, BPI CEO, basically stressed that record labels are very busy at the moment exploring all the opportunities presented by artificial intelligence while seeking to ensure that the technology companies respect copyright and, you know, do what it is that the entire music industry wants them to do. She also insisted that all of that work is ultimately about safeguarding human artistry and the interests of creators. She said in her statement, "Music and tech innovation have always worked hand in hand. AI is no different and offers exciting opportunities as well as new challenges that could adversely impact creators and rights holders if the right balance is not struck." That is why, the statement went on, "With AI developing at pace, record labels are focusing on exploring opportunities to harness this technology and enable further innovation, growth, and support for artists without undermining the strong rights framework that underpins the global success achieved by British music. Safeguarding human artistry and the interests of creators is front and centre in all of this, and the BPI and its members look forward to maintaining open discussions with our colleagues across the music sector as we navigate the dynamic landscape of AI opportunities." So I think in the months ahead, there are going to be two sides to the whole music and AI story. Well, there's a third side as well, but the two sides of relevance to what we're talking about today is the entire music industry ensuring that AI companies and technology companies seek licenses for the music that they use, and that the fair use defense we're seeing in the cases around text-based generative AI don't end up being used in the music space. Meanwhile, within the music industry, the debate around music maker consent and how labels and publishers are going to work with music makers on working out how these licensing deals should be done and allowing artists and songwriters to opt in or not to each AI model. The third strand is, how is music AI as a technology, as something that we use, how is that going to develop? Ultimately, are most of the music AI tools actually going to be tools that are used within the music industry, or are there consumer-facing tools which are not just, you know, a little bit of novelty where we go and we put some vocals in and it spits it out in somebody else's voice? Does that have a long-term value for consumers rather than the music maker community? And if so, how are we going to make money? Because I guess if it turns out that actually most music AI is just about developing tools that musicians themselves use, and there aren't billion-dollar consumer-facing platforms at the end of all of this, then there may not actually be that much money for the industry to share. But who knows? Maybe there is a billion-dollar opportunity, which I guess is why the music maker community want to try and get the politics within the industry sorted ASAP before those $1 billion, if they exist, start rolling in.
And finally, on this edition of Setlist, US recorded music retail revenues grew 9.3% to $8.4 billion between January and June this year, with streaming accounting for 84% of total income. Wholesale revenues, so that's the money that flows from the digital platforms and retailers to the record industry, grew by 8.3% to $5.3 billion. Meanwhile, revenues from the sale of CDs and vinyl in the US were up 5% in the first half of this year, meaning that physical product sales were at their highest level since 2013. This is according to the latest collection of stats published by the Recording Industry Association of America. The trade group's CEO, Mitch Glazier, says this report describes a thriving, growing music ecosystem that continues to reach new heights and shape our culture. And, he adds, it reflects the creative human genius and hard work of all the artists, songwriters, labels, publishers and services who make the music happen and meet fans and audiences where they are in today's forward-looking and innovative music community.
So yes, the RIAA have provided us with another little bucket of stats about how the US record industry and recorded music market is performing. And although we all love stats, we all love some pie charts, we all love a quote from Mitch Glazier. Who doesn't love a quote from Mitch Glazier? I live for these twice yearly quotes from Mitch Glazier about RIAA stats. Although, what are the two main takeaways from the latest stat pack from the RIAA? Streaming is powering the growth with a little bit of vinyl revival are the takeaways. So, I mean, we could have said that 5 years ago, couldn't we? The trends have been there for quite some time now. As it currently stands, premium streaming continues to be the primary revenue generator for the record industry, also responsible for a significant portion of the ongoing growth. So more than 75% of streaming revenues in the US in the first half of this year, and nearly two-thirds of total recorded music revenues come from premium streaming services, where the user is paying their now $10.99 a month to access 100 million tracks. The RIAA report said in the first half of this year, total revenue from paid subscription services grew 11% to $5.5 billion. They also noted that probably a more recent trend is that the revenue from premium streaming is growing faster than the number of new signups to premium streaming in the US. And I guess that's important. I mean, obviously, the price increases that we've seen in the first half of this year, and now even more so now that Spotify have come on board, the price increases will be partly responsible for that. In markets like the US, the growth of premium streaming, which is to say new people signing up for premium streaming for the first time, that is really starting to slow down, because you're kind of getting to the point where anyone who is going to pay to stream already is paying to stream. And we're seeing that certainly in the Nordic markets in Europe at the moment. So obviously, with those markets, we need to get more money from every subscriber, whether that's by simply putting up the prices or by offering add-ons and extras to get more money in. But, you know, positive to see that although the growth of the number of subscribers is definitely slowing in the US, as we would expect, the revenues coming in from premium streaming are growing at a faster rate.
As for ad-supported streaming, both the free tiers of companies like Spotify and the user-generated content platforms, revenues from these services grew at a slower rate than paid platforms of streaming, said the RIAA, up just 1% to $870 million. This, it continues, follows a more volatile period when the effects of COVID-19 stalled growth in 2020 before rebounding in 2021 and 2022. Beyond digital, physical products account for 11% of total recorded music revenues, though vinyl now dominates in that domain, accounting for 72% of that income. The RIAA notes that revenues from vinyl records grew 1% to $632 million, and for the third consecutive year, vinyl albums also outsold CDs in units, 23 million versus 15 million.
Yeah, and in that respect, the US is a little bit different from the UK, because certainly last year in the UK, although we have now reached the point here where the revenue from vinyl is more than the revenue from CD sales, so vinyl, like in the US, is a bigger deal in revenue terms here in the UK. But actually, last year, when it comes to units sold, more CDs were sold than vinyl in the UK, because, of course, generally speaking, CDs sell for less money, but the unit cost is less. So more units being sold of CD in the UK, but more money coming in from vinyl. Whereas in the US, physical now is totally dominated by vinyl, both in terms of units and revenue. So a little bit of vinyl revival, but I guess let's just reaffirm that the serious money and the real growth is continuing to come from premium streaming. No change there.
But that's all we've got time for on this edition of Setlist. If you want to read more about anything we've discussed here, go to the show notes at completemusicupdate.com/setlist. Do subscribe to the show if you haven't already to get new episodes delivered to you automatically every week. Rate and review the show as well. And if you've got anything you want to tell us, you can email us setlist@completemusicupdate.com. It's a new email address. Note it, setlist@completemusicupdate.com. Presented by Andy Moulton, Chris Cook, Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU.